SCP-001 Black Adytum Part 3. When we last left off with the Black Adytum Initiative, Ayun and the others had met with the memory of a second Clavigar, Sarn, who expressed nothing but contempt for Ayun. He had sought a life of peace, along with the rest of the Nalka, but Ayun had turned them back towards war, using Sarn in the same way as their old masters. Even worse, Ayun had perverted their entire belief system by resorting to necromancy in order to turn the tide of their battles. Whereas Nadak offered her the potential of forgiveness, Sarn had no such thoughts in his heart, leaving Ayun even more disturbed than before. With that, let's continue. We pick things up with Chapter 3, The Ossuary of Urok, and are provided the third truth of Ayun, which reads, "Raise your blade if you are under duress and threat. Raise your blade against those who wish to hurt you. But he who raises his blade against an innocent dooms only himself. There are precious few innocents in this world. It is all of our duty to preserve them." We're also given an excerpt from the Record of Ayun, which reads, "So the Nalka were born from the graves of the old masters, building a new city in the name of humanity. And the massed crowds hailed their new shepherd, Ayun, the first slave, the Witch King. 100 hands reached out to caress his cheek and usher him into his new home at the highest temple throne of the nameless city. And Ayun raised a marked hand with a smile and explained, 'For one man to rule a people is for one man to place them in bondage to him, and we are a nation of slaves no more.' But still they cried out for their deliverer to remain with them, and the Witch King sighed, kneeling by the hearth of the old masters, where so many slaves had once been branded and burned. 'I have stolen freedom from the lips of the gods. They look down on man with contempt, for a man is weak and infirm. He lies, he cheats, he steals, and he dies. But that is a man. Men, together, we are bound to each other in unity, bound in bone and blood. And together, men are neither mortal nor divine, but another matter entirely. We are Nalka. We are one. This revolution was only made manifest by my consumption of the Devourer. It is a god that slumbers beneath the earth, full of rage and fury and hatred at man for achieving the freedom it never could. It seeks to twist us, to undermine us, to make us seek to dominate and bind and control each other. But it carries with it such great power." And here the Witch King raised a finger, and a Nalka found his bloodied eye healed. "My duty to you, my Nalka, is to watch over this creeping force. I will wrest the secrets of the gods from its maw and deliver them unto you. But you must deliver each other, for if one Nalka suffers, all of us suffer the same." And so the Nalka relented, letting the Witch King take refuge in the tunnels below. But they asked for a name for this city. Adytum. The perfect city. But this is not Adytum yet. It can only be made so through our own blood and sweat. By January 10th, 2042, the Black Adytum Initiative had departed from the burial site of Sarn and were in transit to the next location indicated by Ayun, a point in Mongolia. En route, Zhang and Xenophon were asked to report in to O52 and Para-History Division Director Hussein via satellite uplink. O52 comments that they have been busy between Sa'arn's tomb and the conversations with Ayun, and asks for a rundown of the bioanalysis. Xenophon replies that, as a peace gesture, the Grand Karsus submitted to a battery of minor medical examinations, along with a number of other Sarkites. It confirms what it had already begun to suspect, that there is a bio-anomalous basis to the Sarkic genetic memory phenomenon. All of the Sarkites' blood exhibits a mutated strain of the bacteriophage that Drs. Aram and Nussbaum cataloged in 1984 as SCP-610, the flesh that hates. Unlike the aggressive viral strain that the Amani-Ram Initiative discovered, however, this strain appears to coexist endosymbiotically with the host's red blood cells. Unsurprisingly, it exists in the highest density within Ayun and Yeva, having mutated further to coexist within cell types other than erythrocytes, including skin and muscular tissue. O52 is surprised that Yeva agreed to be tested, but asks for Xenophon's analysis. Xenophon states that it believes this to be the original SCP-610 strain, while the one discovered in Amani-Ram was an ancient weaponization of it. It seems to exist symbiotically within the Sarkike's blood, and is likely the source of their capacity for genetic memory. Their density and spread within the Karsus bodies is probably the origin of their carnal mantic abilities, and it imagines that the hereditary passage of the virus is also the cause of the Sarkic's higher-than-normal frequency of birth defects. O52 says that this makes enough sense, and tells Xenophon to keep working on a biological basis to see what it can find. It, however, says that even these limited medical examinations aroused deep suspicion, and further investigation will require an elevated level of trust and good faith exchange with the Sarkic. O52 then asks about their slow pace towards the next location, and Xenophon explains that morale is low among the tribe, as the revelations from Sa'arn have disturbed the Grand Karsist heavily. O52 just tells them to figure it out, as they don't have the latitude for further delays here. Zhang says that his rapport with Yeva is pretty much gone now, as she's hardened against them, but Xenophon seems to be getting along with Ayun. Xenophon agrees to continue conversations with Ayun, but mentions that it was under the impression that this wasn't a high-urgency project. Hussein chimes in to say that he thought the same, but O52 says that he doesn't want to hear from him. They have verifiable evidence now that the Sarkic are the direct continuation of the Nalka, that this Ayun is the same as the past Ayun, and most critically, that the Nalka were an ancient empire and Black Adatum exists somewhere. His hypothesis is toast. Hussein is silent for several seconds before replying that all of that depends on the assumption that the memories experienced by the Grand Karsist are trustworthy. Assuming this is the same Ayun, they're hedging their bets on the damaged memories of a genocidal dictator. Xenophon states that it doesn't believe there is any reason to think the Grand Karsus' past actions inform her current behavior, while Zhang says that he doesn't think she's intentionally hiding anything. She seems as invested in finding out what happened to the Nalka as they are, maybe more, and she's their only lead. If the memories are accurate, though, she's the same person that did all this, and they'd be fools to blindly take her at her word. O52 tells them to keep following and listening, but take what she says with a grain of salt, as memories are fickle. However, the Council is convinced enough that they're authorizing them some additional resources, consisting of 4 more heavy transports and a mobile research lab, along with about 40 more personnel. Xenophon is then dismissed from the uplink, while Zhang stays connected to discuss a few things regarding Project Locust. Zhang remarks that he's not on the Locust staff, but Hussein actually reprimands him for referring to Xenophon as a he rather than an it, as it's not human. He also says that for that matter, the Sarkites aren't either, so he should try and stay objective. Zhang simply obediently agrees and is dismissed. Xenophon asks a 56-year-old farmer what being sarkic means to him, and he replies that the life they choose is difficult, depending on Yeva and the Grand Karsist for healing instead of medicine. They work the fields with their hands and their livestock instead of the machinery others use. When his children were born, he struggled with it, as every parent wants their child to have an easier life than they did. Should they have to struggle like this? He has never forced them, but they grew older and they decided for themselves to stay. Being part of this is seeing his children grow and find the same things in their life important as he does. We're then provided another excerpt from The Truths of Ayun, which reads, "Lo, gaze upon me, you blind, you cripple. Look upon my face, and know that I have spent my days in the depths of our tomb city, burning the bones of our brethren, seeing what lies in our future. It brings me no joy to return what truth I have, but it is truth. For we all know, the truth lives in the bones. We march towards a war with forces that bring with them no mercy, no honor. This is not a war for land, for then we would parley. This is not a war for honor, for we have no hatred in our hearts for these foreign invaders. This is a war against the very notion of our existence. For while we have existed for centuries, unmolested and free, expanding our borders to hold our people and our farms and our villages, in doing so, we find ourselves facing an old enemy and a new one. The hated old masters, those that clapped irons around your fathers and your fathers' fathers and their fathers too, they have found us again. And they bring with them the Eastern machines, who reject the humanity we hold so dear, sawing off their flesh. They both worship their fell gods, brethren of the Devourer, and they have seen how we live free, subject to neither man nor God, and they are enraged. They march on us to free the Devourer and make us slave to its hateful whims. The Nalka will not be slaves again. I ask those abled to rise in defense of not only your families, but your very existence. Uruk has graciously accepted the burden of commanding our forces. But we are at war now, my people. Sacrifices must be made. Hard decisions must be made. Adatum has not the resources to aid our infirm and defend our people at once. We are one body, and we are only as strong as our weakest organ. And we cannot fight a war if we care for the weakest among us. The art of the flesh cannot fix all. Those of us who are suffering, from constant illness, from stupor, from weakness of the mind, have been released from their misery. They have been consumed, and their memories and strength live with us as we now move unburdened by their weight. I plead with you to know I do not make this decision lightly. I spent 3 days and 3 nights with the maw of the Devourer, wrestling it for another option, but it gave none. It wants us to fail, to be freed from its city prison. We cannot allow it to win. We carry the flesh of our fallen with us forever, and now we must defend the city they love." Per O52's orders, Xenophon met with Ayun when the initiative made camp that evening, heading into her tent as the campfire inside burns with bones baking inside of it. It finds Ayun near the rear of the tent, hunched over a cot and whispering, and she turns, revealing Yeva to be laying on the cot, wrapped tightly in bandages. Ayun tells it to fetch the poultice by the fire, which she promptly puts into Yeva's mouth to chew. Xenophon asks if she's conscious, and Ayun says that she's somewhere halfway in between. She then takes a blade and cuts open her own palm, letting the blood drip into Yeva's mouth while she whispers. She explains that she's alleviating some of the pain and aiding in the healing process as she lifts the sheet off of Yeva's leg, revealing that Yeva's missing leg now shows a growth made up of tightly intertwined snakes, each of them pulsating as they breathe. Xenophon comments that her abilities are improving exponentially, and Ayun says that she fed her clavigars their power from her flesh once, and now they feed her. Before she continues, Xenophon says that they should speak outside, as it doesn't think that Yeva would want it to see her like this. The two step outside to another campfire, and Ayun says that Yeva is wary of the Foundation, but she doesn't trust Xenophon. It replies that it knows, and she would not show it vulnerability if she were fully conscious, so it would be wrong to take advantage of her not being so. Ayun remarks that if all their treatment by outsiders were as fair as this, they might not have receded from the world so much. Xenophon says that the Foundation has come a long way in the past few decades, but Ayun asks if it believes that, or if it was built to believe that. After pausing for a moment, Xenophon ponders if there's a difference. The two sit in silence for some time, until another Sarkite brings Ayun a bowl of stew. Xenophon asks how it is, to which she just says that it's good, although she imagines that it wouldn't know what that means. It replies that humans enjoy well-spiced food that engages the taste receptors. Ayun just says that that is not what makes food good, explaining that the meat in this stew was Hatak once, the man whose funeral they attended. His wife shared his life with him for 43 years, and they had 2 children and countless experiences together. Now she cooks with his flesh, with the love she shared with him as much a part of this meal as his flesh is. Xenophon comments that many people would not associate cannibalism with love, although to it, both of them seem trivial. Many animals have complex family structures, reasoning abilities, and some level of self-awareness. Pigs are particularly capable, even on tests informed by human conceptions of intelligence, but they are still farmed in mass for meat. Love, meanwhile, drives people to irrational decision. Ayun agrees, but says that they are not always the wrong decisions. Love is why Ipla spent 43 years with Hatak, and it is why Ayun is helping Yeva perform her ritual. Xenophon counters that it is also why Sa'arn continued to serve her, and she made the decision to raise her dead to protect her living. Ayun's face falls, and says that she doesn't know what to think about that. If this enemy was as dangerous as she thought, if they truly meant to enslave them again, then maybe it was the right decision. She looks around and sees her people, and she struggles to think of any decisions she would not make to ensure their survival. Xenophon says that those sound like Yeva's thoughts, and Ayun says that Yeva feels that Ayun wouldn't have done it unless she had to, with no other choice. Xenophon comments that it's an understandable thought, but it thinks that she's asking herself the wrong question. It doesn't matter if it was correct at the time or not, nor does it matter how Yeva feels. Ayun raises her voice, telling Xenophon that death and consumption are sacred to them, and it cannot understand. Xenophon supposes that it can't, but asks her how she feels about it now. Ayun says that she feels full of regret, fear, and guilt, and so Xenophon tells her that she can't reasonably answer for actions taken 3,000 years ago, but her reaction informs who she is now. Ayun, however, says that she did it once, so who's to say she won't do it again? She cannot ignore her past, as she wouldn't have done this, resorted to this sin, using her people like this, if it had not been needed. She then asks why Xenophon is raising this matter now, so it honestly explains that its overseers are concerned that her mood over the past week has contributed to their slowed pace. She snorts in response, and says that it has nothing to do with her mood, but the rituals with Yeva simply exhaust the both of them. The worst of it is past now, however, so they can return to their earlier speed. She continues taking sips from her stew, and then asks if it gets jealous, seeing its fellows eat, knowing it cannot. Xenophon replies that it does not get jealous, but it would like to know what food tastes like. Ayun says that there is no good way to describe it, but she can make an attempt. She states that she tastes this stew, and it reminds her of warm summer nights, sitting with her back to the steel and her feet to the bonfire as they toasted the grains from the harvest, assured that while tomorrow would bring its own worries, tonight was calm and peaceful. And listening to the little ones point out and name the stars, marveling at how they could be the exact same stars she saw in her childhood. Xenophon nods, and the two continue looking up at the starred sky. Afterwards, the Black Adytum Initiative quickly resumed the average pace prior to encountering Sa'arn's tomb. Researchers made requests to investigate Yeva's flesh art exemplified in her new limb, but she rebuffed these requests, while Ayun remained cooperative with regular interviews with Xenophon. She recalls that Sa'arn was a boy when she met him, little more than a child, as the old masters picked him early, and the priestesses spent his youth shaping him into their agent. With 100 slaves to one slaver, they chose young children to turn into their agents, plying them with extra bread to report on their fellows when they knew no better, until it was habit. If that was unsuccessful, they simply whipped them into it. Sa'arn was smart for his age, and resented being used and turned into a monstrosity. She showed him that he was no monstrosity, that humanity exists regardless of what form the flesh takes. Humanity was something inside, something immutable, and while the old masters had made their bodies into tools, his body could now be whatever he wanted it to. She remembers the awe on his face, as that was when she first realized what they were fighting to free. And when it was all over, and they had settled into their new lives, he came to her, asking for her blessing. He had served dutifully in the revolution, and now would like nothing more than to settle into a quiet life. Their borders were already expanding, as their people married and bore new life, and he had seen a plot of land by a river, not far from Adytum, seeking to spend his years there. She knelt by the fire, and saw into the bones for his future. She saw him suffering, taking lives, fighting off foreign invaders, wrapped in the violence and treachery he hated. She feared for what she had seen, that if he took this home by the river, that his farm would be ransacked by bandits and raiders, and he would meet his end at the edge of a sword. She worried for him, and asked him if he would do her this favor, to stay in Adytum with her and the other Clavigars. His father was dead, so she was the closest thing to a parent he had. She didn't want to lose him, and so she tightened her grip. He was saddened, but understood, as they were in the midst of a grand work. Their neighbors were princes and warlords, and nothing like Adytum existed anywhere in the world. She needed him by her side, so he made it his task to ensure the children in the city, those orphaned by the war, were cared for. He walked with her authority and carried the seal of the Grand Karsus. She raised her Karsus like they were her children, but Sa'arn was her son, if not by birth. He would do everything for her, but he never raised a blade until she asked him to. She saw him cutting down the generals of the gold-draped legions and slipping into the palanquin of a priestess to slit her throat. Only then did she realize that the carnage she saw in the fire so many centuries ago was what lay before her now. She says that it was necessary. It must have been necessary. Several additional para-history division personnel were transferred to the new site, located atop the archive of Nadok, to assist with translation efforts. As material was translated, digitized copies were transmitted electronically to Xenophon and shared with the Grand Karsis. We're provided another excerpt from the Truths of Ayun, which reads, "Lo, gaze upon me, you wandering, you lost. Gaze upon the same scarred visage your fathers gazed on once, those centuries past, when we were shackled and yearning for freedom. Gaze upon the same bloodied face that brought your ancestors their freedom. You are their children's children. You are what we hoped for, a generation that has never known the threat of bondage, the threat of servitude to anyone save each other. Your ancestors and I made this bond in blood, that our Adatum, the one that lived in our hearts and minds, would be made manifest on Earth. We hoped you would be able to live in that city one day. Alas, I look upon Adatum now, centuries after our revolution, and I see that I have not honored my bond. I have not done enough for you, for them. Do not be fooled. Remember the superficiality of flesh, how easily it can be molded and shaped. Remember that truth lies in the bones under the surface. We have not made Adatum manifest yet, and this is why we find ourselves face to face with the machines from the east, why the old masters encroach on our borders again. They submit to gods, and if they make war on us to force us to submit to our mangled god, they will succeed, for we have never truly escaped submission. Uruk, my Clavigar, commands our forces in our colonies with honor and dignity. But we are not doing enough for her here in the capital. We must marshal our strength and focus our energies. Not every choice can be decided by our collective. Our humanity asks of us to argue, to deliberate, to not act until we are certain. But now and again, we must silence that voice. Now and again, a decisive hand is needed to guide our yoke. It cannot move burdened with the weight of the masses. It must rise above the fray of autonomy, see the whole board, and make decisions accordingly. I have taken this responsibility for myself. The devourer roars constantly beneath our feet, hungering for our downfall. But I keep its shackles taut, and so I can reach into its gullet and draw power, the power to unite Adatum and the Nalka. I know better than any the blood and sweat with which we clawed our freedom, and bile rises at the thought of placing myself as your ruler. I know better than this. I will make no decisions you would not approve of. I will take no action you would not take. But we must have someone to take control, and I submit to this task. It cannot be the whole body that holds the sword. It must be the hand." The Black Adatum Initiative proceeded into the Mongolian interior, approaching the location marked by the Grand Karsis. Xenophon and Zhang approach Ayun as she's feeding and watering her horse, asking if her and Yeva are ready to depart. Yeva then emerges from the tent, her crutches nowhere in sight, as she walks with an odd, lurching gait. Glimpses of the snake-like leg writhing and swarming are visible beneath her dress, causing several researchers and a few of the Sarkites to stare at it. Yeva's lip curls, and she says that she is not an animal to be ogled, and she doesn't need anyone to slow down for her. She then turns and makes her way to one of the horses, awkwardly clambering onto it. Gradually, the researchers and Sarkites return to their tasks, although Ayun has a frown on her face. She then says that she's ready to go, asking how far away they are. Xenophon replies that at their current pace, they should arrive by nightfall tomorrow, and they can begin exploring the area for Urok's tomb the following morning. It then asks about her horse, as the side of its face is marred by bulbous growths. Ayun looks at it for a few seconds, blankly, before saying that he's fine, as she brushes her fingertips against the horse's fur. The skin on one of the masses peels back, revealing an eyeball, disturbing Zhang. She says his name is Lujat, meaning to see far, and then says that she needs a few moments to gather her things before they leave, and she'll need Xenophon's assistance to carry the tent. After Zhang leaves, Xenophon notes that her tent has already been packed away, and she says that she lied. The Foundation already doesn't trust Yeva, and she doesn't want whatever fleeting disagreements she has with her to poison their opinion of her. She is a good child, and she loves her like her own daughter. Yeva disagrees with her, but she doesn't stop loving her. She sees that she is hurt inside, and although she wishes to help her, she doesn't know how. She doesn't know who she is or who they are. Ayun grooms her to guide these people, but she never will, as she ages while Ayun stays the same. Yeva questions her decisions, but does not listen when she explains her thoughts. She wasn't always like this, though, as she was the sweetest little one. A horn sounds across the camp, signaling the wagons have been packed, and the convoy begins to move. Xenophon asks if she was born injured, as it has observed that they have a much higher rate of deformities and birth defects. It believes that that is caused by the SCP-610 strain within their blood. Ayun gives Xenophon an amused look, asking if that's what they call it, as the Sarkic call it their curse and their treasure. The first generation of Nalka were injured through their bondage. Scars of whippings and canings, broken fingers and severed digits. They were made monsters, but they reclaimed their humanity. She can heal them to what they were, but to go further is beyond healing. It is flesh art. Many didn't want that, as they wanted the reminder of what they had fought so hard to escape. They wanted to know they were human, as they defined themselves by their imperfections. The ones after the first generation were born stunted, with hunched backs and crooked jaws and malformed limbs. The seeping influence of the angry god whose blood ran through her veins. She offered healing to any who wanted it, but her gifts are drawn from cursed blood, and any healing imparts more of the curse unto her victim. She cannot make them perfect, as her gifts are not infinite. More of a feeling, an artistry, as she cannot stop death, just slow it. As for the Holocaust, that was just moving flesh, with no spirit inside. That was not halting death any more than closing one's eyes is halting life. She could not keep them alive, only puppeteer their bodies, and even that is a perversion enough to make her stomach turn. Xenophon asks how she is still alive if she couldn't halt death, and she stares at it for several seconds, before saying that she doesn't know. She only remembers fearing it, screaming at the toothed maw of the devourer to tell her how the gods had conquered death. She doesn't remember anything about it after that. The Nalka were all born with defects, but it was nothing to be judged. It united them, as underneath the shell, they are the same, one soul. Xenophon says that that was until she rejected it, and she shakes her head, saying that she must have had some reasoning. It is, as it said, though, that it shapes her decisions now. They carry that tradition with them, and do not ask to be born this way. Xenophon replies that they could fix some of the more obvious cosmetic defects, and she asks why, so that they could fit in when they sit in the rest of the world's offices and shops. She snorts, and says that they are not ashamed of who they are. Xenophon counters that they are not its offices either, and Ioun says that she often forgets that it is not human. They ride silently for some time, until Xenophon says that her abilities are growing rapidly, as Yeva's modifications were beyond her reach not long ago. Ioun says that she can feel the blood of the beast stir and awaken as she discovers who she is. As for Yeva, she desires answers that do not exist. She has lived her whole life with Ioun, with her teachings, and now she sees sermons she has given, things she has said, that go against everything she was taught. Yeva cites her words to her, and she doesn't know how to tell her that she doesn't believe any of it. Xenophon states that it's a confusing time for all of them, but Ioun says it's more confusing for Yeva. Ioun's people look to her as a distant source of wisdom and guidance, but Yeva's the one they speak to with concerns about their children, or their health, or the harvest. She is the one they have grown with, the one they know. They love Ioun, but they trust Yeva, and she has always trusted Ioun in turn, until now. Xenophon suggests that she talk to her, and Ioun says that its attitude on Yeva confuses her. She bitterly dislikes outsiders, and Xenophon more than most. She finds it to be an abomination, and their friendship confuses her. Xenophon asks about their friendship, to which she says that it doesn't treat her like an exotic beast to gawk at, like the others from the Foundation, and she enjoys speaking to it. Xenophon asks if that's what defines friendship, and she replies that it can be. Xenophon is silent for several seconds, before saying that she is also interesting, and it enjoys speaking with her, so they are friends. She snorts in response, and it says that its overseers are also concerned about their friendship. She should speak to Yeva, as even though she doesn't trust it, she evidently cares about Ioun as much as Ioun cares about her. She sighs and says that she knows, but that's why its attitude towards her confuses her, as she expected it to be angry at Yeva's behavior. Xenophon replies that it doesn't get angry, and Yeva is doing the best she can. Ioun says that the guns trained on their heads disturb Yeva, and herself as well. Xenophon tilts its head, stating that the security personnel are here for the protection of the initiative. She asks if they are, and nods towards one of the transport vehicles, watching as the gun atop it slowly moves to track the movement of a nearby group of Sarkites. Ioun says that she doesn't think its superiors consider them as much a part of this project as it does. Xenophon continues watching the movement of the gun until Zhang calls to them from behind, pulling Xenophon away. He says that he just wanted to check in, asking if everything is okay. Xenophon replies that all systems are optimal, asking if there would be a reason that they would be otherwise. Zhang just says that the Sarkites can be kind of odd, and some of the researchers are a little surprised by how well it's getting on with the Grand Karsis. The other Sarkites haven't been nearly as receptive to their efforts, and the researchers are more than a little disturbed by them. He's glad they brought their own rations, as one of their kids offered them a bowl of stew a few nights ago. They're all under instructions not to eat anything they offer, which turned out to be the right decision, as it ended up being the guy they sacrificed. Xenophon counters that they didn't sacrifice him, as he was already dead, and many human cultures practice endocannibalism as a funerary practice. Zhang says that it's read the same translated records that he has, so it knows that they are pretty deliberately not human, going by the Grand Karsis words. Xenophon says that she doesn't remember making that sermon, and no longer agrees with it. Zhang just shrugs and says that she still said it, and he's just going off her actions. Xenophon replies that for the Sarkites, sharing food with outsiders is considered a significant gesture of hospitality, so spurning it is considered an insult. Perhaps that is why their researchers have struggled to engage with the Sarkites. Zhang blinks, stating that he never got that impression, asking where it picked that up. Xenophon just says that it spoke to them, but Zhang replies that that's easier said than done. Not to mention, he's not going to be able to convince anyone to eat person stew, and he can hardly blame them. They'll figure out something else, and in any case, it doesn't have to worry about that. It's lucky, as it doesn't have to eat at all. Xenophon replies that, yes, it's lucky, with a hint of sarcasm. Xenophon later asks a 29-year-old craftswoman what being Sarkic means to her, as she whittles a statuette out of a femur. She says that they do not worship a force they cannot see, or a cruel god that makes them suffer. Being Sarkic, to her, is to worship themselves. They are all filled with an incredible light, and they grow and change. They can learn and do anything, become anything. She asks if that isn't more worthy of honor and worship than dreams of a hand reaching down from the sky to make wrongs right. They are not perfect, as these same gifts fill them with flaw, and they are arrogant and foolish. They make mistakes, but they try to fix them, as they choose to honor themselves and their humanity. It will never understand, but perhaps it can see. We're then provided another update from Delta Zero, indicating that Project Locust personnel are surveying several sites of interest along the border of Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan. Atreus array readings indicate a low level of residual ontokinetic activity, consistent with the theorized effects of the passage of a Class 5 reality bender. Director Hussein is evaluating sites near the Caspian Sea and inside Afghanistan, being advised by Delta Zero personnel accordingly. The Black Adytum Initiative has arrived at the next suspected location of interest, planning to survey the site in the morning. The embedded agent reports further low-level tensions between the researchers and the Sarkites, as well as the exponential increase of carnomantic abilities in both Ayun and Yeva. Given Yeva's distrust of Foundation assets, the agent suggests prioritizing focused surveillance of her. They also report that Ayun largely trusts Xenophon, and it is functioning within expected margins. In the early hours of February 1st, 2042, the initiative began to search for the resting place of Uruk, both on foot and by drone. The wide, flat plateau is covered with sand and loose rocks, with only dying shrubbery to break it up, and Xenophon comments that there is nothing here. Yeva hisses at him in annoyance, telling it to be silent, as they are close. Yeva and Ayun are both surprised that the others do not hear the sound of shuffling feet, and a researcher informs Xenophon that the ground-penetrating radar didn't turn up anything. They request satellite support, and Zhang says that they're better off just waiting for the satellite pictures, as there's nothing here but rocks. Xenophon agrees, but then pauses, staring down at the ground for several seconds. It then slowly reaches down, picking up a small chunk of sun-bleached rock before crushing it between two fingers. It states that this is hydroxyapatite, a salt formed of calcium and phosphorus that is the major mineral in bones. Slowly, the group realizes that the vast field of white rocks they are standing in is actually a mass grave from a battlefield. Ayun then says that this was an accursed place, as two battles were fought here, one to attack and one to defend. A rousing victory and a crushing loss, first against the old masters, then the traitors. She says that Uruk fell in battle in the name of the Nalka, in her name, here. She stumbles over to a spot and drops to her knees, digging single-mindedly at the dirt with her bare hands. Yeva joins her, before recoiling with a gasp, as the sharp bone fragments have sliced her fingers. After whispering to herself, however, the multitude of cuts close, leaving raw skin behind. Xenophon tells Zhang to bring the excavation transports over, but Ayun continues digging wildly with her hands. Xenophon steps over to pull her away, but Yeva shouts at it to not lay its hands on her, and Zhang comments that it probably shouldn't interrupt the memory. Slowly, the glassy look fades away from Ayun's eyes, and she rises unsteadily to her feet, supported by Xenophon. She's confused, looking down at her shredded hands which are pouring blood, but without even praying, her hands begin to knit themselves back together within seconds. The transports begin to dig as Xenophon asks her what she saw. She says that she saw a battle, with Uruk blotting out the sun and holding the line. Several hours later, as the digging continues, Xenophon enters Ayun's tent, finding Yeva there instead. It tells her that it hopes her leg is healing well, but she just snorts and says that it doesn't need healing, as it's better than it was before. Xenophon states that it saw her limping, but she explains that that's her other leg, clubbed from a lifetime of leaning. Xenophon then says that her new appendage is very impressive, and she's surprised that it isn't disgusted by it, although she doesn't say anything when it asks why it would be. The two sit in silence for a few moments as they wait for Ayun to return, until Yeva suddenly asks Xenophon why it was made. It replies that it was made to assist the Foundation in historical research projects, which it was told when it was first activated. From the moment it had awareness, it knew its instructed purpose and moved to fulfill it. Yeva says that it is a tool, like a hammer, which exists for one reason and one reason only. It never has to wonder or try to reach beyond it, and there is comfort in that. Xenophon counters that hammers are not sentient, and it disagrees that that is comforting, as the hammer does not get the opportunity to decide its purpose. Yeva scoffs at this, stating that humans do not decide their purpose, just stumble blindly around until they wrap their fingers around something they can claim as their purpose. Many never find anything. Xenophon asks if she would prefer it to be told to her than for her to find it for herself, and she asks in turn if a hammer would choose to be anything except for being a hammer. Xenophon agrees that it probably wouldn't, but all living things should have the opportunity to choose. Yeva then asks if Xenophon can disobey its purpose, and it admits that it cannot, and she snorts again. Ayun then returns, and Xenophon tells her that the excavation has located something for her attention. Ayun immediately heads back out of the tent, but Yeva stops Xenophon, asking if its body can feel pain or tire, or if it can break. It replies that it doesn't feel pain or fatigue, and barring a truly destructive force, its body will not break. Yeva replies that there is at least one thing uniting them then, that they have both seen the frailty of the human body. She then leaves the tent as well, with Xenophon following. They approach the excavation site, where a huge pit has been dug, revealing a massive humanoid corpse, at least 20 feet in height, with thick arms and legs. Unlike the bodies of Nadok and Sa'arn, it is not intact, instead covered in deep cuts, slashes, bites, and gouging wounds. The fatal wound appears to be a deep cut around the throat, leaving dried blood spilling out around the neck. Zhang and several researchers are in the pit, taking photographs and measurements of the body, while Ayun stands at the edge, staring in. She says that this is Uruk, her strongest, who fell in battle defending her people. She always trusted Ayun's orders, and was fearless in faith. She then slides down the wall of the pit, clambering on the corpse with a knife drawn, and Zhang shouts for everyone else to back up. Ayun rests the tip of the knife against Uruk's chest and turns to look at Yeva, who doesn't return the look. She then drives the knife in, spending several minutes sawing through the sternum and splitting the chest open, staining her arms and robes bright red with blood. She spreads the ribs apart before reaching in with both hands, drawing out a huge heart nearly the size of her head. She states that this is a courageous heart, the heart of a warrior, and then spends the next few minutes hungrily devouring half of the heart. She kneels on the chest for a moment, panting, before letting herself fall into the gaping hole in Uruk's chest. Yeva hastily clambers on the corpse to follow, along with Xenophon, but Zhang elects to skip this one. Xenophon drops onto the body and into the cavity, and when its cameras reactivate, they show the same field that they were in, but now littered with fallen bodies. A massive, hulking figure is directly ahead, surveying the damage, dressed in hugely oversized hide armor. Uruk's upper body dwarfs her lower, forcing her to support herself on her clenched fists. Uruk turns to face Ayun, and her facial features are surprisingly soft, with flowing, braided hair. She smiles, sighing in relief, and speaks in a slow, booming voice, saying that she's waited for Ayun to come back for so long. She had said Ayun would come back, but the other Clavigars didn't believe her and said that she was lost. She knew that she'd come back, however, sooner or later. She steps towards the group, fists landing heavily and crushing a body underneath. Ayun approaches her, wrapping her arms around the massive hand, and Uruk says that Ayun loved them too much to leave them. She knew that. Ayun asks her why she is here, and Uruk looks down in confusion. Ayun apologizes and explains that she doesn't remember almost anything. She remembers the revolution, the old beast, Adatum, the war, and then nothing. Uruk pauses and looks up at the battlefield, asking if she remembers her. Ayun replies that of course she does, by her side in the quarry from the very beginning. She was always the strongest of them, her strongest, at the forefront of every battle. She led their forces during the revolution, and then again during the war. Uruk straightens her back slightly, standing taller with pride, and Ayun asks her if she knows what happened to her. Uruk tilts her head and says that she changed, but she's not sure when. Ayun was softer at the beginning and never angry with her, but then time wore on. She went from spending time in her temple to spending time in the catacombs, talking with the beast. Then she was harder, angry often, with her and the other Clavigars, even yelling at her sometimes. Ayun leans her forehead against Uruk's fist, apologizing again. She says that she wishes she could tell her what happened, and wishes she could make it right, but she doesn't know how it all went wrong. Uruk knows that she didn't mean it, she just wants to know why, and she begins treading away from the battlefield. Urak says that Ayun was always wise and always knew what to do. Nadak was smart, but didn't always know what to do, and that's why she was their leader. She always had a reason for every decision, so they listened to her and loved her. They would have followed her to the ends of the earth, and they did, far past where they should have. Urak listened to her even when her voice changed and grew hard, when it was no longer her speaking. They reach the edge of the plateau and can see the steppe extend for kilometers, with multiple villages in sight, either burning or reduced to rubble. Urak asks why this, as this wasn't what they wanted, and wasn't what she wanted. Ayun says that they wanted to enslave them again, but Urak replies that it had been centuries, and maybe their priestesses did, but these were just farmers that wanted to be left alone, like they did. Yeva says that their hordes would have come, but Urak says that they never allowed for the possibility. Ayun must have had a good reason, though. She must have. Ayun stares down at the spread of burning villages and can see the horde of Nalka assemble in the distance, like a fleshy growth on the land. She replies that it was war, but Urak says her change began before that, and she began taking charge, overruling the Nalka's decisions and granting her Karsis broad authority. Maybe the people didn't notice, but the Clavigars noticed. Urak suggests that maybe the four of them weren't enough for her, as she went into the earth and communed with a fell god, seeking out greater power. Ayun says that of course they were enough, as they were her Clavigars, her family. Urak asks again, why, as she must have had a reason to send their armies here, to do this, and to throw away everything they built. Ayun doesn't know, however, and Urak turns to her, asking what she saw in the fire. When she wasn't in the catacombs, she was always staring into the fire, into the future, terrified. Ayun stares down into the burning villages, fire dancing in her eyes, and momentarily the sky dims. Ayun says she saw something coming, something grand and dark and vast and unstoppable. A black moon hanging low in the sky over Amun-Ram, over Mamjul, and then over Adatum. The machines could not stop it. The Deva could not stop it. The Nalka could not stop it. Humanity could not stop it. She had to stop it. They stand in silence on the cliff edge, and Urak asks if she was enough, even though she didn't win for her the second time. The scene then suddenly shifts, showing the same location, but now in the dead of night. Below them, over the cliff edge, the lights of the Sarkites can be seen. A train of wagons and people thousands strong, running from the destruction of Black Adatum. Further down the plateau, a collection of 100 soldiers are massed, dressed in Nalka hides and furs, with a cloud of dust rising on the horizon in the distance. Urak says that they were behind them, and a choice had to be made, so she stayed behind. The dream they had in the quarry went with Ayun, and Adatum with Ayun. She would do it again, happily, but she failed her. Ayun replies that she was never going to win, and she didn't fail her, but Ayun failed all of them. The dull, loud thundering on the horizon gets louder, the cloud of dust in the distance growing. And Urak asks if she was enough. She lowers her head, and Ayun kisses both her cheeks, leaving a bloody print behind, telling her that she was more than she ever deserved. Urak says nothing, but smiles as her skin and muscle begin to decompose, the memory decomposing along with it. When Xenophon's cameras reactivate, they're standing on the edge of the pit, although Ayun is still in the pit. Urok's corpse has withered to just a massive skeleton, and Ayun is kneeling by the skull, pressing her forehead to the cranium, with tears streaming down her cheeks. We're then provided another translation from the bones recovered from the archive of Nadak, which reads, "I saw less and less of him as the war dragged on. I understood he had his duties just the same as the rest of us, and I was never jealous for his time. The days he spent in the catacombs turned to weeks, turned to months before he would emerge, haggard and emaciated. Blood dripping from his lips where he had supped on divine flesh to learn its secrets, carrying them back to us, insisting he needed to go back down to keep the beast chained. Even his most loyal Karsus feared to tread down there, in the most knotted labyrinth of mausoleums and tunnelways, knowing that a mistaken turn could lead to a slow, painful death, starving while wandering in circles. The other Clavigars were disturbed by the whispering voices inescapable in the catacombs of Adatum, whispering godly secrets and unholy arts. And so it fell to me to descend into the earth to fetch my love when the Clavigars needed him. I carried the oldest maps, drawn in his hand, and walked through bone-lined ossuaries and through passageways tight enough to crush my chest. I followed the faint sound of his voice coming to me from deep beneath the earth, the weak whimpering, the ecstatic moaning, the purring, the screaming, the demanding, the threatening, the crying, the pleading. When I reached the bottom, the cornerstone all Adatum was built on, I found myself facing a set of massive doors as tall as 10 men. They were sealed shut, and through them I could feel a great and dark power and pain. Something older than life and the moon and the stars, great and grand enough to consume me alive. And then the door opened, and his sunken eyes and gaunt cheeks were facing me, and I saw the terror he had done so well to hide. I pulled him into my embrace, kissing his cheeks and ignoring the blood leaking through the doorway behind him, ignoring that I knew the cries were not his. In the present, Xenophon tells the individual that Ayun didn't speak for 2 days after this incident. She was shocked, as were all of them, but her worldview was fundamentally shaken because all the events in her memory were suddenly recontextualized. The individual replies that they don't understand what was so staggering to her, and Xenophon explains that Urok had pretty much stated that the fall of Adatum was Ayun's fault. Whatever she had done, she was responsible for the collapse of the city, for the exile of her people, and the miserable existence they have been living for as long as Ayun can remember. Xenophon heard her crying in her tent and wanted to help her, but wasn't sure what to do. In fact, it's not sure that there was anything it could do. The individual replies that that's part of being human, too. It's clear now that Ayun was responsible for the fall of the Nalka, more so than any other outside civilization, but it's still not entirely clear, both to us and to her, as to why. She apparently began communing with the god underneath the city, Yaldabaoth. But what exactly was exchanged between the two is still a mystery. There's only one Clavigar left to meet with, Luvatar. But as you can imagine, the answers that Ayun will find aren't going to be pleasant.